Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Monday, the 6th of May. We tell you it's the roundtable so you don't think that it's a morning edition and don't expect long lapses of silence.
That's a shot. Oh, that's awful.
That's a shot because NPR really screwed it up this
morning. They had some problems this morning, so we'll try. We just want you to know, hey, we're going to try to fill in all the time this morning. We've got a lot of show for 3 hours. We begin this morning with our panel, as always. WAMC's Alan Chartok joins us, WAMC's Ray Graff. Our special guest this morning, Dr. Alan Keller, director of the NYU Bellevue Program for Survivors of Torture. It is the only program in the country providing medical, mental health care, social, and legal services to torture survivors. Dr. Keller has also worked in support of state legislation in New York that would prohibit participation in torture by New York licensed medical professionals. Dr. Keller has testified before Congress and made a number of media appearances, and we're thrilled that one of those media appearances is right here on the roundtable. Dr. Keller, thank you very much for being with us in the studio.
Good morning. My privilege to be here.
Thank you so much. Talk to us about this legislation, because I ask the question because is it a problem that New York State doctors are partaking in some form of torture?
Well, first, thank you for your kind words in introducing me. I should just clarify, there are actually over 25 centers in the U.S. and 100 worldwide who care for torture survivors. And that's because there's an estimate, it's estimated that there is nearly 500,000 men, women, and children around the country who have endured torture and other human rights abuses. So it's sure, if you know refugees or immigrants who fled here, many of those individuals have suffered unspeakable horrors. And so in part what I do in both in this care and in the advocacy, I'm thinking about my patients.
My understanding is your number is somewhere around 700.
We care for between 700 and 1,000 patients each year. Since we started in 1995, we've cared for over 3,000 men, women, and children from more than 95 different countries. And tragically, the world being what it is, business is booming. We have more than a 4 to 5 month waiting list for individuals to come and get care through our program.
And how much is domestic? In other words, you've talked about the international cases. What about people right here, police departments and others?
Well, it's not to say that police violence and the consequences of that are not a problem. The focus of our program is in caring for among the most vulnerable New Yorkers. Personally, we would love to expand in those areas, but literally from the moment we opened our doors, there's been a waiting list. And though there's maybe not enough services for individuals who've suffered at hands domestically, there are at least still some services for them.
The LGBT community is large in what you
Yes. The LGBT community and individuals persecuted because of their sexual orientation is probably among the fastest growing segments of the individuals we care for. So a gay male from the Middle East, or a woman who is a lesbian from Africa. Individuals maybe not tortured directly by the state, but brutally harassed, beaten, abused, and the governments there not only didn't do anything to stop it, they encouraged it.
There's a lot of issues that we need to talk about. I do want to focus in for a moment, because it's why you're here in Albany, and that is to support this legislation, to lobby for the legislation. Now, talk about this bill and what it ultimately would do.
Right. What this legislation does is, frankly, very common sense, but as we know all too often, what's obvious is not so easy to implement. This legislation says that if you are a health professional who participates in torture or a severe abuse of a patient, of a prisoner, that can, not will, but can be grounds for loss of licensure. And this is consistent with every code of professional ethics since the time of Hippocrates.
So how many do we know of? Is this a problem in the sense of, are there doctors that hold a license in New York State that are participating in some form of torture or in aiding in that?
So your question speaks to the issue, why should we care? Why as New Yorkers should we care?
Well,
so,
no.
No. Okay.
No, Mike.
We're getting to that part.
No, I'll get to caring. But my question specifically is: we're having legislation that, as I read it, is it would prohibit participation in torture by a New York licensed medical professional. So my question is: how many New York licensed medical professionals do we know of who are engaged in torture?
Well, I'll tell you, you remind me, as my wife, who is a former assistant district attorney in Manhattan, would say, just answer the question. So I will do that.
Okay.
Well, we don't know the exact number, but given that New York trains more future health professionals than almost any other state in the nation, it's likely that we have more health professionals serving in the military around the world. And the reason that's important is, in order to practice medicine, whether it's here, in Iraq, in Timbuktu, wherever, you need a license. And that license is issued not by the federal government, not by the army, but by the state. And so the state has a long history across the country, states, that of regulating professional conduct. And in fact, I think nearly half of cases of professional misconduct brought are because of things that happened outside of the state. So this is totally consistent with the way we oversee and who oversees professional misconduct.
Well, it's obviously violative of the Hippocratic Oath, right? I mean, you know, do no harm. But are there conditions that you would say, and I would wonder whether you want to extrapolate this to torture itself by anyone, that torture is called for?
Right. Well, you know, we're all too familiar with the ticking bomb scenario,
sure,
which makes for very good TV, whether it's 24 or Zero Dark 30. But in reality, the analogy breaks down like a house of cards. So I don't believe there is justification for this. And even if in the short term you thought you were going to be getting some useful information, and in fact everything we know about torture has shown that it's very effective at getting people to talk and very ineffective at accurate information. Case in point, the weapons of mass destruction. We can debate about whether or not we should have been in Iraq, but we went in based on inaccurate information, in part elicited by torture. So I would argue that, you know, wrong information is even more problematic than none.
I wonder if you could give me quickly, I know it's requires a detailed answer, but how do you define torture?
I define torture, or torture is defined both in United States and international law, as severe physical or mental suffering inflicted for a variety of reasons, information gathering, punishment, or humiliation by somebody acting in an official capacity or at the behest of the state. And when you look at torture worldwide, and by the way, this is another reason I care. It's documented in over 100 countries, and we seem to be the only people who think this is somehow effective information. Everyone else in the world is using this because they know that it's effective at breaking bodies and minds and sending a chilling message of control that if you dare to speak out or do whatever, this is what will happen. So we're the only ones, it seems, who are deluded into thinking this is any useful means of accurate information gathering.
You say severe physical or mental. So how, that's a relatively subjective term. How do you get to the point where everyone agrees that this is severe? In other words, somebody doing interrogation in Afghanistan might as well say, well, this is not severe. This is fine.
Well, you know, I'll tell you, if it looks like torture, if it smells like torture, it's torture. This is not subtle. The individuals I care for and have evaluated, a Tibetan monk who chanted, "Long live the Dalai Lama, free Tibet." He was arrested. He was beaten. At one point, they said, you know, "You're not doing anything useful with your hands." He was also writing poetry critical of the government. And they thrust his hands into a coal-burning oven. So, again, these aren't subtle things. Yeah. So I know there's – and in fact, in the infamous memos by Jonathan Yu, who should have lost his right or privilege to practice law, there was a lot of dancing around this word severe. And in those infamous memos, I think what it was defined as severe is permanent end organ damage or death. Kind of harsh because – a lot of my patients may not have any physical scars.
Yeah.
If a gun is held to someone's head and the trigger pulled in a mock execution, that may not leave any physical marks, but the nightmares and the terrors go on forever. And unfortunately, health professionals for years, for centuries, have unfortunately, though most do promote healing, many have been involved in torture. Hmm. It's not a new phenomenon.
Now, we know our friend, our mutual friend, Dick Gottfried, has been helpful in this. What about the other house, the Senate?
Well, in both houses, we've been really fortunate to have very dedicated, champions and sponsors. Senator Tom Duane, who retired, was the initial sponsor in the Senate, and most recently, Senator Brad Hoyleman is our sponsor. And it's Senator Hoyleman's first term, but I know he's passionate about this. He cares. And he gets it. He gets why this is important for our state and then for us to lead the nation on this.
Yes, but what about the Republicans?
Well, you know, this is one of those issues that I believe transcends politics. This is not a Democrat or a Republican issue. I believe as Americans, we can all agree that torture is not who we are. Number one. Number two, that it's actually counterproductive and makes the world a more dangerous place. We actually have many retired generals, several of whom are Republican, working with us because they know that at the end of the day, torture not only doesn't get us useful information, but it puts our troops in harm's way, both when they're out serving, and also when they come home.
But in all due respect, I wish you would stick to your wife's instructions.
Oh.
What about the Republicans?
On behalf of my wife, thank you very much for that. Honey, I'll answer that. Well, so first of all, the reason I mention them is because several of those individuals are Republicans. Look, we're working hard right now to gain Republican co-sponsors. We previously had a Republican sponsor. I'm blocking on his name. He was a retired dentist who had served in the military.
Appropriate.
And we're actually meeting with several. We're actually working much harder this year, coming up with medical students, future lawyers, and others, and meeting with both Democrats and Republicans. You know, look, politics in this town better than anybody. So I understand how this issue can get entrenched, but we're actually very optimistic that we will get a number of Republicans to support this bill.
We're going to take a quick break. When we return, we will continue our conversation with Dr. Alan Keller, director of the NYU Bellevue Program for Survivors of Torture. He is our guest this morning on our panel. Alan is here, Ray is here, and we welcome your comments. Roundtable at WAMC.org. We'll be back after this short break.
Support for WAMC comes from Riverbend Animal Hospital, Route 9 in Hadley, Massachusetts, providing small animal medicine and wellness care, general and referral surgery, canine rehabilitation, laser therapy, and dentistry. RiverbendAnimal.com. Subsidium Technologies, providing design, implementation, and management of communications networks. SubsidiumTech.com. And Steve Lewis Subaru, Hadley, Massachusetts, a new and used Subaru dealer serving the Pioneer Valley, Hartford, and Springfield, offering new Subarus plus used cars, trucks, and SUVs. SteveLewisSubaru.com.
Welcome back to the roundtable. It's 25 minutes past 9 o'clock. We're discussing the issue of torture this morning. Our special guest is Dr. Alan Keller, director of the NYU Bellevue Program for Survivors of Torture. Alan is here, Ray is here, and we welcome your comments at roundtable at WAMC.org. We just have about 5 minutes before we go to a news break, and we'll come back and have more time to discuss. But before we go to the news break, three words, Senator Greg Ball.
Senator Ball, well, we actually did go to meet with individuals in his office. Unfortunately, we didn't get to meet with the senator. I've heard his comments.
And just for people who don't know, this is the senator who, after the Boston bombing attack, tweeted that he believed that we should use torture on, quote, this punk to save more lives.
Right. So, first, I get his visceral reaction. I was rounding the bend at the Lincoln Tunnel when the first plane hit. I actually know people who died. Somebody who grew up in my town died overseas serving our nation. So I get the stakes. And I will give the senator the benefit of the doubt that in his role of chair of the Senate, you know, Armed Services or Veterans, he cares about our vets. And I'm hoping, and in fact, I dropped off a report from the Constitution Project, a bipartisan commission, including individuals, Republicans who served in Homeland Security, that made the same points I did, that these methods do not work. And ultimately, they feed into the hands of those who would do our country harm by providing a gold mine of propaganda.
But in the end, the harm had already been done. How do you get that information then if these techniques don't work? In other words, is there a truth serum? Is there some way that you can get the information fast that says, oh yeah, there are six more like me, they're right around Boston. How do you do that?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Truth serums. Actually, truth serums really should be called talk serums because they make individuals talk and hallucinate, but they're not necessarily telling the truth. It doesn't sound very sexy or doesn't play well on television necessarily, but having spoken to many interrogators, both current and former, what I hear over and over again, that really both in the emergency situation and the long term, it's about rapport building. And frankly, given the narcissistic, crazy, whatever personalities of those who do these things, getting them to talk is not necessarily so difficult. So really, it's rapport building is what you hear from the individuals who've been doing this for years and know about interrogation.
But can you build rapport in the 6 hours you need before the next bomb goes off?
It's been actually shown, I believe, that you can. But that ticking bomb scenario and the 6 hour thing, it's much more of a myth than reality. And you know what? I personally don't think you should ever be doing this. But the bottom line is laws and legislations are not built for these rare, what if, one in a gazillion time things. Our legislation needs to be based on what happened. So may there be an exception? I would personally think there's no reason for a health professional or anybody. But I suppose if somebody did what they did and they thought they were doing the right thing, then fine. Let them be held accountable for it.
Yeah.
But the issue is when you condone it in any way, it is so much easier. One thing I've learned, we like to think that torture is done by two-headed monsters. It's not. It's done by ordinary individuals who think they're doing the right thing. So what we hope, and what we've also learned, by the way, is that doctors were front and center in this case, in the case following September 11th, and frankly, as we learned in Nuremberg and elsewhere, doctors were front and center in driving this torture to occur by giving it the white coat stamp of approval. So that's why we believe that if we empower health professionals to live up to their codes of ethics by saying, I can't do this, I'll lose my license. Maybe it won't happen.
Dr. Alan Keller is our guest. We're talking about torture. We'll continue after this short break. Welcome back to our roundtable panel this morning. WAMC's Alan Chartok is here. Ray Graff joins us. And Dr. Alan Keller is our special guest. He's director of the NYU Bellevue Program for Survivors of Torture. It is a program providing medical, mental health care, social, and legal services to torture survivors. He is also in town today to gain support on state legislation that would prohibit participation in torture by a New York licensed medical professional. We welcome your input as well, roundtable@wamc.org. Without oversimplifying this, Dr. Keller, it seems in our earlier conversations that when it comes to torture, we can either be doing it for A, punishment, or B, as an interrogation technique to gain more information.
Well, there's a third, and the most common way it's used is as a means of sending a message. I mean, Robert Mugabe, you know, one of the great sociopaths of our time, the dictator of Zimbabwe, he's not using torture, nor are the Chinese against Tibetans, to get information or to punish. They're using it to send a message. If you dare to speak out against for human rights or for democracy, this is what will happen to you. So while torture is grossly ineffective at eliciting information, it's highly effective at, you know, generating fear. And I think, frankly, as those who would do harm to our country, Al-Qaeda and the other evil sociopaths, they know that this is a really effective propaganda tool to use against us. And we shouldn't give them that tool. We're better than that.
Doesn't that then transfer? In other words, if they live, if Al-Qaeda and those live by fear, and they do this for fear's sake, then, and I'm not saying that this is a good idea, but if our people in the field then catch a guy and torture him, and he goes back and says, hey, I've been tortured, doesn't that say, hey, listen, we're also playing by your rules, you may fear us now? Well, I'm not saying that's good. I'm just saying, isn't that something to think about?
Well, there's a few things I would say to that. First of all, I've never viewed Al-Qaeda as the moral benchmark by which we should do our own behavior.
Absolutely right.
Second, actually, I think when they go back, what happens is that generates fear and hatred. You know, during World War II, it was a very well-known fact that the German soldiers preferred and would willingly surrender to American troops because they knew they were going to be treated respectfully rather than to the Soviets. And by the way, in World War II, and I'm not saying we do this with our detainees, the most effective interrogation tool, rapport building, some of the most useful information we got from high-ranking Nazis was one of our great interrogators used to play chess with these individuals. Now, I'm not saying do that. I'm not saying play golly gee, aren't these poor, misunderstood individuals. No, what I'm saying is you have to do everything, keeping in mind what's the goal. And the goal is to make our nation safe. The goal is to live up to whom we are. And by the way, as I've said, ultimately, this is terrible for our soldiers. And so I would hope, and I believe that Senator Ball really, and the other, all of the other senators care about our fighting men and women. And so if for no other reason than for them, they should support this bill and to prevent torture. Because, one, it feeds hatred and propaganda. So I think our soldiers are much more at risk. And two, we've learned that those soldiers who participate in these things, when they come back, it actually makes them, I believe, at much higher risk for post-traumatic stress and suicide. So the last thing we want to be doing is putting our soldiers in places where they're doing things that when they come back, quote, to normalcy, will have scarred them for life. Torture is not benign for the torturer.
When you testified before the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, you noted many – you gave many examples of what we're talking about. And some we've talked about within the context of our conversation, some we have not. Sleep deprivation, stress positions, sensory deprivation, violent shaking, sensory overload, exposure to extreme cold or heat, sexual humiliation, waterboarding, which of course we've heard so much about, beatings, threats of harm to person, family, or friends, exploitation of fears and phobias, medical ethics, and interrogations. I want to talk a little bit about is it typically a handful? Is it all of those? Is it it can be any one of right. actual technique?
So among the thousands of torture survivors I've evaluated, including individuals who were previously detained at Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo, and it's important to note that overwhelmingly, I think like 95% or more, were ultimately released without ever having been charged. Rarely do I see an individual who had one thing happen to them. Usually it's all of the above. They're being sleep deprived by loud music being played, bright lights, threats are happening. Dogs are, near them. They're being forced to stand, naked. So when you're doing that, you're, one, using humiliation, and two, standing for long periods, despite, some assertions to the contrary, is really harmful. If you stand for long periods, which is, quote, one of the enhanced interrogations, which is nonsense. That's a sanitized word for torture. Standing for long periods causes pooling of the blood, which can cause blood clots. Those blood clots can go to the lungs and you can die. This is dangerous. This is brutal. There is no way to make it safe.
When you look at the movie Zero Dark Thirty, which was nominated for an Academy Award, and Catherine Bigelow was the director, of course, known for The Hurt Locker. When you look at that film and how it represented torture, I think it gave many people maybe their first glimpse as to what that is like. I'm curious. I'm going to lead the witness a little bit, but I'm curious as to what you thought about that particular scene and ultimately the film.
Right.
Shartok, turn your phone off.
Well, first of all, I would say, and this is again, as Dr. Keller, the film goer, I actually liked the film. I thought it was a good flick. In terms of its accuracy, it was way off the mark. And I'll tell you, I was really...
As far as accuracy when it comes to...
When it comes to...
Torture?
Well, with a couple of things. One, that it misled that torture somehow was necessary or effective in getting information that helped us. There is not a shred of evidence to that.
Okay, but I'm talking about – I understand that. I'm talking about the depiction of torture, though. I mean, of what they were doing to the individual.
Well, so, it did capture some of the brutality, but the reality is far worse than anything they showed. And the other part that was not lost upon me was there was the one scene where, the individual who was tortured is suffering terribly, and then the next he's having coffee with his interrogators and seems kind of fine. You know, just like on 24, where the lead character, when he is tortured, he sort of shrugs it off and walks into the sunset. That doesn't jive with reality. This is just one of the most damaging things. And, the last thing I'll say about Zero Dark Thirty is at the very first scene of the movie, the very first thing, there's a line that says, based on a true story. The very last scene of the movie, and I was maybe the only person left in the theater because I took a film history course in college, and the teacher said, if you leave before the credits, you fail. So the very last screen says some of the events have been fictionalized and
sure.
blah, blah, blah. I would encourage the filmmakers, even in the video, I wish they had switched those two because you're left with thinking this is reality.
So my question for you, and the way I say leading the witness here, but when it comes to people who have been tortured, how do they get to you? How do they get to NYU? How do they get to your program?
Well, we get about 5 to 10 new patients a week, and they come to us from a variety of sources. They may be referred from different immigrant community groups, such as from the Congo or Sierra Leone or the Tibetans. They may come to us from attorneys representing them in asylum proceedings. Word of mouth. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised, and it's always gratifying, that based on things like this, that individuals literally show up at our door. There's one individual that I'm caring for who was from a Middle Eastern country whom I first met like 10 years ago. And he initially got some care and then kind of went away. And, you know, 8-10 years later, he's still having sleep problems. He's still having nightmares. He's still having a lot of back pain. And so, you know, it's a process. And I'll tell you something. I don't find my work morose. It's gratifying because I know we help rebuild lives. I have patients of mine now, you know, working as nurses, as doctors, as psychologists, becoming U.S. citizens. And so it's really, really moving that there's nothing we can do to undo what happened, but there's a lot we can do to rebuild lives. The most stressful thing in my life is that, you know, raising funds to help the wait list outside of our office. That's what keeps me up at night.
Now, you want to punish doctors who participate in torture. So what about the State Medical Society?
Right.
Where are they?
Well, first of all, I need to qualify, and I believe this is responsive.
You don't like the word punish.
Well, part of this would be that if you are a health professional who does this, you can lose your license. It will be handled in any other way of professional misconduct. An initial triage, and if there's not accurate information or it seems bogus, it will be dismissed. I actually view this legislation more than anything else as preventive. Doctors were coerced. Doctors are like everybody else, and we're coerced into participating. And I would hope this bill sends a message that or enables an individual a tool to say, I can't do this. I'll lose my license. With regards to the Medical Society of the State of New York, I have met with them several times. They have not actively opposed the bill, but they have raised concerns. And my
what are their concerns?
My understanding of their concerns, I guess, is a slippery slope that, gee, what happens if this is somehow extrapolated to, say, a doctor who provides bad care for a patient, they suffer and they die? And my answer to them is, well, that may be malpractice, but it's not torture. And I will, on this show, publicly offer the Medical Society of the State of New York, if they ever have one of their members or a case that they think is bogus or frivolous, I take this really seriously. I would, at a pro bono, for the rest of my life, free of charge, serve as an expert witness. And my Aunt Sophie, may she rest in peace, lived to 106. And so
that's amazing. Randy on the show.
Yeah, no, I like this.
I encourage the Medical Society of the State of New York. I understand their concern about being legislated, but this is consistent with every professional organization. The AMA has clearly stated that this is wrong. So, frankly, I'm baffled, but I'm still optimistic that the medical society will step up and do what's right for our profession and for the citizens of the state of New York.
Ultimately, if this were to be successful in New York, then, unless all the other states are on board, then, okay, doctors maybe suddenly will not want to do service. So suddenly then you get doctors from Georgia, more from Alabama. Shouldn't this be better done on a national level?
Well, licensure professional licensure has always been under the purview of the state, and that's not going to change. And we believe on this, like so many other things, New York can, will, and should lead. Other legislation is actually being considered, I think, in roughly half a dozen other states. So I think this is just the start. And part of the reason you need this is to codify it's wrong. There was a professional misconduct charge brought against a psychologist, John Lesso. And embarrassingly, although the New York State Psychological Association opposes or supports this legislation, the National American Psychological Association unfortunately has been behind the wheel of a lot of the torture that occurred or that their members have. John Lesso, a psychologist licensed in the state of New York, who was a senior psychologist at Guantanamo, and not just was a passive participant, but was basically saying, hey, this guy has a sleep phobia, or this one's afraid of insects. Use that. Charges of professional misconduct were brought against him by the Department of Higher Ed, in the department, who came out with...
Here in New York.
Yes, here in New York. Yeah. A complaint was filed with them. And their decision was, well, maybe what he did was right, maybe what he did was wrong, but we looked at the definition of the practice of psychology in the state of New York, therapy evaluations, and he... You know, this wasn't the practice of psychology. To which I say, what do you think he was there as? He wasn't there as a plumber. He was applying his expertise. So again, this is very commonsensical, and it's by the way, this is a revenue neutral, I know, important in these times legislation. It's going to be handled like any other charge of professional misconduct, that you can lose your license, but individuals may decide, or those adjudicating this may decide no.
I want to take a quick break, but before, because you mentioned the word revenue, what does it mean? Does it mean revenue for the doctor's getting paid to do this, yes?
Well, the doctors who serve in the military are being paid, but I meant the assessment.
No, I understand what you mean, but what I mean is for if I am a doctor and I'm partaking and I'm helping in some form to tell you that okay, this person has this phobia, use that. Am I being paid for that service, for that expert opinion?
Well, yes, you may well. If you're serving in the military and you're there, you're being paid. And two, if you were hired, you know, to observe an interrogation, then yes, you're being paid. And so, in fact, this bill also states that health professionals should not be present at interrogations. And it's not that that most or rarely are interrogations torture. It's
But doesn't it make sense to have a health professional there in case it goes too far?
Well, unfortunately, you know, what we've learned, and this has been backed up in psychological studies, I wish the psychologists would read their own studies, that when you have those situations, that individual does not become a protector. They become more of an enabler because they are there at the behest of an authoritarian figure, the government, and it's like, well, maybe what's happening isn't so bad, so we'll let it go. And then the interrogator, if they cross the line to torture, and overwhelmingly most don't. Any interrogator worth his or her, you know, whatever, doesn't do this. But they think, well, if it gets really bad, they'll stop me. So it's a vicious cycle.
We're going to take a quick break. We will continue and wrap up our conversation with Dr. Alan Keller, director of the NYU Bellevue Program for Survivors of Torture. We welcome your input as well. Roundtable at WAMC.org. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.
Support for WAMC comes from the Brain Injury Association of Massachusetts, celebrating 30 years of support for brain injury survivors and their families in the Berkshires and beyond. BIAMA.org. And Albany Marriott, with 359 guest rooms, special event and meeting space with internet access, the Market Restaurant and Martini Lounge, and airport transportation. Facebook, Twitter, or AlbanyMarriott.com.
Welcome back to our roundtable panel this morning. WAMC's Alan Chartok is with us, Ray Graff, and Dr. Alan Keller, director of the NYU Bellevue Program for Survivors of Torture. Dr. Keller is working with state legislators who are looking to forward legislation that would prohibit participation in torture by New York licensed medical professionals. You and several generals, brigadier generals, are going to be lobbying today. And what does the day hold for you?
Right. Well, first, we have the support of a wide coalition. We have retired generals. We have students. Our future health professionals get it. We have religious leaders. We've spoken with religious leaders right here in Albany who support this. They get that it's wrong. So what we hope to do today is Rear Admiral General Cullen is going to be joining us in meetings, mostly with Republican lawmakers. And he will articulate, I believe, the case that these methods are not effective. They put our soldiers in harm's way. And in harm's way, I want to be specific. I talked about, you know, the risk of hatred. But there was a very powerful book by an author, Josh Phillips, called We Were Not Like This Before. And what he found is there was a group of soldiers who served in a battalion that ended up being working in a feeder prison to Abu Ghraib. They didn't sign up to participate in torture, but that's what happened. And it really had a horrible effect on them. That battalion had one of the highest suicide rates of any battalion because when they came back to the real world, it haunted them. So I have a very clear message for all of our legislators that if you care about the core values of our nation, if you care that you wouldn't want to be treated by a doctor who tortures, if you care about our veterans, you will support this bill that can begin, maybe in a small way, but every journey starts with a step to prevent this from happening. An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure.
With that said, and certainly I agree with you, but just for the heck of it, have you ever thought of a single situation in which torture would be justified?
I understand the emotional appeal. I can't say that, you know, if my daughter were buried somewhere, you know, in a grave,
or an A bomb was about to go off, and
yeah, exactly. So I too get easily sucked in by this emotional appeal. And you know, look, the bottom line is legislation can't be done because of these outliers. I mean, might there be a case that somebody says, "Hey, I needed to do this," but then they need to be held accountable. But what we need to be careful of is allowing the ticking bomb to tick out, you know, not only for hours but days, weeks, months, or years. And overwhelmingly, we know that even in that scenario, it's not effective. You get useless information. So there's an emotional appeal in this, like, surely we must do something. But I would say to our assembly members, senators, doctors, and others, above all, do no harm. And in that situation, probably most of the time you're doing more harm. I mean, yes, you know, I understand the emotional appeal. I don't think it's ever appropriate. But could I see circumstances that somebody might do this thinking it is? Perhaps. And then fine. Let them justify. Let them explain what they did. And maybe those reviewing this would say, well, there were mitigating circumstances. The legislation says you can lose your license. You can be charged with professional misconduct. It doesn't say you have to be.
Dr. Alan Keller is director of the NYU Bellevue Program for Survivors of Torture, and it's been a great pleasure to have you with us. Thank you very much for your spending your time, and best of luck with your work today. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much.
I do want to give a website. It's www.survivorsoftorture.org, survivorsoftorture.org, and we'll tell you more about your work as well as how people can find out more information. Dr. Keller, thank you very much. Gentlemen, thank you very much as well.
Yeah, thank you.
Coming up next, the roundtable will continue. You're listening to the roundtable on WAMC.